Welcome to CKUT on the disability panel. So the listen talk about the disability rights and the issues and all that. So we're going to start with the first question. Hello, Tanya? Hello? I think we lost.
No, I'm there.
Oh, you're there. Good.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Oh, so great.
So like that. Tanya, would you like to speak about your teachings in the area of disability students?
Thanks very much. Not only do I teach students with disabilities, I also teach disability studies. So, and which is a unique approach in that instead of learning things about disabled students, what we try to do is study the conceptions that people have of disability. And those conceptions could be the conceptions that we see on the news or when we're going to school, or sometimes how medicine and doctors talk about disability. So we try and study all the different ways that people talk about disability and use our own lived experience. Like I'm dyslexic and some of my students have other disabilities, and we use that experience as a way to, I guess, give a little trouble to some of the conceptions that people are stigmas and stereotypes that some of other people might hold for towards disability.
Like my opinion too is like in the disability, like I don't like when doctors use the term the R word.
Like, yeah,
I think it's not, it should be knocked off of papers and all that. I think it's a racist word. So like that.
Very belittling.
Yeah. So like that. So what do you bring in the areas of disability studies fits at the University of Toronto?
Do you mean in terms of access in the University of Toronto or education? Or
you could get both.
Yeah, I guess they both go. That's I guess that's what we're trying to do, is both simultaneously. Yeah. Is well, studying conceptions that people might have of disability, also trying to change how we organize a classroom, because almost everything, all the words we have for disability and all the programs and procedures, almost all of it is geared to individuals. And we don't often think of, well, what are we doing as a group to make our classroom welcoming or accommodating? What are we doing as a group that might be able to let people who might learn in different ways or take notes in different ways or want to think in different ways, what are we doing as a group to enable that? So I think one thing we're trying to do here, at least some of the time, is talk about thinking about disability as something good to think with, but also trying to think about it in new ways, because hoping to invite, I want disabled people in my classroom. So how can I build a classroom that says, I want you here, instead of go get accommodations over there someplace else, which is necessary, but that's not the only way, I don't think.
Okay. So I think I like that. Actually, I'm a little dyslexic too, so I just lost myself in my questions.
Yeah. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
To get lost in your own questions, and it leads to new questions.
Yeah, new questions. Yeah. So like that, I think I read two questions and what happened? It happens at the University of Toronto in the terms of accessibility and disability rights?
Yeah, part of what's happening here at the University of Toronto is that we're trying to study how disability has and hasn't been written into collective agreements or into equity statements, into ordinary policies. So we're actually sort of at an exploratory stage. Even as the University of Toronto as an organization is implementing a new law called the AODA that's trying to be more accommodating towards disability, while the administration is doing that, those who do disability studies are trying to study the ways that disability might not be yet included into some of the policies and procedures. So we're trying to figure out how to make sure that disability gets included as an equity issue. And one thing we've done is started at the graduate students' union and at other students' unions. We've tried to start now having an accessibility committee, which is trying to do more than just abide by the law. Instead, we're trying to figure out ways, again, how do we make an invitation towards disability to say that disability is here, and how can we invite people to want to be more inclusive?
Okay. We heard you speaking about the policy in
unison
before, and could you please tell our listeners about it?
I think the government, this is now sort of an old document, back to 1998, but they've been using it all the time. It's called In Unison, A Canadian Approach to Disability Issues. And in everything the government, the Canadian government has been publishing in terms of advancing their publication titles, one of the major ones is Advancing the Inclusion of Persons with Disabilities in Canadian Society. But their basic principle that Canada's been following for quite some time now is to say that persons with disabilities participate as full citizens in all aspects of Canadian society. The full participation of persons with disabilities requires the commitment of all segments of society, and the realization of the vision will allow persons with disabilities to maximize their independence and enhance their well-being through access to required supports and the elimination of barriers that prevent their full participation. So that's been the government's approach. And what's really interesting about the government's approach, and crucial, is that it focuses on we want inclusion, and if we're going to understand disabled people as included, particular individualized supports will be offered. And we all know some of the time in some places, and those supports oftentimes disappear. One thing that we've, in disability studies, one thing we've been focusing on is how is it that we continually regard disability as an individual issue and not as a collective issue? So how could we, why do we offer supports for individual students, but we're not really offering supports for entire classrooms to say, what are we doing to exclude people? Or how come I don't ever have to think about putting things in regular size print and in larger print or in another format? Or why don't I read things aloud in class? Why would I just put something up on the board and expect everybody to see it, to read it, to understand it all in the same way? So how are the In Unison documents that has been informing government policy now for quite a few years, it isn't supporting us to regard disability as a collective issue, even though disability is one of those things that we all have, or we all are related to somebody with a disability, and yet we treat it like, oh, just this individual has a disability, instead of we as a collective, we have disability. Now, how can we make living with disability a good thing, a productive thing, an artistic thing, a poetic thing to be with disability? How can we make that something that we want instead of just a procedure to accommodate an individual who may or may not be welcome in our midst?
Okay, that's good. Thank you, Tanya. Just stay on the line because we'll have more discussions.
Okay.
Now, next I'm going to move on to Tara. Yeah. Could you please tell us about the social supervision interest?
Sure. Thank you for having me on. I'm really happy to be here. So my scholarly and supervision interests really started quite a while ago, I guess, more from work in the field. Around 15 years ago, I started by working in a community in a small home for adults who had developmental disabilities. And I, at the time, saw a lot of injustices and a lot of exclusion, and this was for me a catalyst to come to do graduate studies in Montreal and focus a little bit more on some of those areas. So the areas that I primarily look at have to do with self-determination, advocacy, making sure that in one's life that there are choices and that these are respected, and that the basic human rights associated with one's experience, particularly in education, is that those are respected. And I'm really interested also in the transition from school into the community, whether that be related to work or other kinds of community activities, because what tends to happen is we see that students may be supported in educational programs and throughout secondary school, but then there isn't really planning or any kind of support and interest, I guess, in making sure that there is a move from the school and that people still have access to the same kinds of accommodations that they require in whatever is out there for them after school.
Okay. What are your particularly interests in?
So some of the things that I really care about have to do with self-determination, like I mentioned, and advocacy, making sure that that individuals have access to choices and that those choices be supported, that they are able to realize their potential, their path, and their strengths, and to recognize what their rights are and how to advocate for themselves and for accommodations. One of the other areas that I'm really interested in is quality of life, and particularly for individuals on the autism spectrum. It's quite astounding if you look at the published literature in the area. In terms of quality of life, we have thousands and thousands of articles around the world. It's a really established area. But in autism, looking at quality of life of individuals on the spectrum, there are only two published articles. So it really hasn't been an area that people have really been concerned about. People are more concerned about early intervention and notions of curing and those kinds of things than they are with actual subjective outcomes of individuals later on. And so for me, that's really important to start to recognize and include in research the voices of individuals on the spectrum. So
why?
I think if we're thinking of equity-seeking groups, and I know often disability rights have been talked about as the last civil rights movement, and I think in some ways the autism movement is the last of the last civil rights movement. Really, basic human rights have been denied and not recognized, and for me, I really feel that we need to start putting a lot of focus on that, on and placing our energy in actually, you know, promoting good quality of life outcomes, and like I said, recognizing, you know, the empowerment and the power of the individual in their own path.
What about your research team?
Okay, I direct a research team that I'm very proud of, I have to say. We're called SPARC, which stands for Social Policy Advocacy Research Community. And it's a group that is quite diverse. We have students from McGill. We have volunteers. Also, we have students with a variety of abilities and from a variety of backgrounds. We have students also who identify as having disabilities. And essentially at the core, our mandate is to promote social inclusion and with the recognition of a shared responsibility for positive outcomes for people with disabilities. And we do a lot of work and setting up programs in the area of self-determination and empowerment with a variety of groups, some who have developmental disabilities, some who are considered at risk for because of environmental reasons. And we have a lot of different projects on the go, but our main mission is that in our core set of values.
How is the areas of social contact, social includes, mm-hmm. and social policy for people with developmental disabilities fit in at McGill?
It's interesting to think about this because these are all the areas that I have cared about, and I really liked getting this question in advance. It gave me a lot to think about. In some ways, I thought that I cared about these things a little bit separately, but then when I was thinking a little bit more about how they're related, I can definitely tell the story of how I feel that they are. So the social cognition part really comes from the work that I did in my dissertation, which was essentially taking a critical examination in a very experimental way of a deficit model of social cognition. So, you know, the recognition of social scenarios. And the research that I did, I looked at this social orienting deficit and kind of deconstructed it a little bit and found that individuals with autism who were on the spectrum did not actually have a social orienting deficit, but actually required more time to process the information, but that, you know, that was intact. So that, I feel, is a really important key to getting at the other more abstract concepts, I guess, like social inclusion and policy. We need good, solid research, ones that are critical of a deficit model and find good experimental design to address those. And I think that also, you know, addresses the issue of stigma in research sometimes, even in the most seemingly scientific approaches, that we end up really excluding individuals. And it also feeds into the idea of social inclusion and exclusion. And these, of course, the practices that we have, the data that we present, and how we present them in the spin that we give on them, also impacts policy, which then in turn impacts the lives of individuals again. So I feel that all of these are really related. And as researchers and practitioners, that we have to be very careful of the messages that we're sending out in the, you know, variety of projects that we have.
Okay, yeah. Now we're going to move on to Marie. That's right.
Maria.
Okay, sorry. Can you please tell us a bit about equal access?
Sure. I think I reverse the question and say, because your next one is why do I think equal access needs to exist?
Okay.
I spent the last 30 years helping people set up groups, equality-seeking groups in area of disability, join together, for example, down in Canada, disability and women. I've come to the realization that the environmental movement was once again ignoring the issue of disability. So Echo Access is actually a consulting group. What we do, me and the person that works with me, Gary Gay, we give out workshop, we do consultation on various issues. We come together with nonprofit organization, with profit organization, with business and government if they want. And we provide them with workshops on various issues on disability as well as ecology. We have drawn up the philosophy of Echo Access is universal design. And so if we're talking about academic, like Tanya was talking about before, we encourage universal design of instruction, which basically would eliminate all the barrier that exists presently in the system, in the academic world. It would design classes and material to be accessible to everyone.
Okay, so like that. Right, so you asked why do you think access exists? Basically,
it's a job. I graduated from McGill in 93 with a master's degree and found that I couldn't get into the profession despite the fact that I had a master's degree with perfectly good grade. I work as a researcher as a paid job on a regular basis, on a part-time basis, but it wasn't fulfilling the needs that I wanted to do. It's not the kind of work that I wanted to do. I want to be able to join together, make people aware that they need to start. They need to become accessible at the very beginning because it costs less. That's what universal design is all about. It costs less to start being accessible at the beginning rather than retrofitting, which costs a lot. If we take, for example, the metro station, back in 88, the group I was with, Le Regroupement des Consommateurs Handicapés de Montréal, we had told the city at the time that the metro needed to become accessible at that point because baby boomers were becoming older and we would acquire different level of limitations.
And now they're just starting, so it's not going really good because they don't have them at every metro. So
exactly, and with the new group that I'm with, if they go at this rate, the metro would be accessible only by 2085.
Mm-hmm.
None of us will be here at that time.
Yes,
So basically, this is the kind of philosophy we promote, universal design, inclusive design, to just change the social structure so that the next generation doesn't have to go through what we're going through.
I'm going to add a question on, I interviewed Lise Poulin, which is in city council wheelchair and like that. What do you think about her going into city council?
I don't know much about her policy. We haven't seen much of her.
Yeah.
But our own philosophy is that it's not, of course, person with disability. I don't disagree with what Judy said last night. Person with disability need to be forefront. But if your philosophy and if your thinking is not one that encourages what Tanya was talking about, that is not an individual problem in the person, but a social problem that affects everybody, whether we are wheelchair user like me, hearing impaired, or what have you. It is the social structure that needs to change.
Yeah.
Because I would hate to go from a women's movement to the environmental movement to black movement to first people's movement just to teach them what needs to be done to make.
Yeah.
There are people with disability in each of these movements. The environmental movement, there's no reason why the recycling bin cannot be made accessible right away.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So like that. You were talking yesterday that the Voices of Change conference yesterday with Judy Heimlin?
That's right.
And what was the name of
Stephen?
Stephen
Estee.
Yeah, you want to give your views, opinions about that?
I think, they've made quite a few. They were instrumental, both of them, in the passing of the UN Convention on Persons with Disability. I was there for a little while in the beginning of 2000. I was quite active in the women's section of the UN Convention. So we have made some step up.
Yeah,
there's still a lot to be done.
Do you think it's more like you're just walking into the door and pushing disabilities rights?
I think that, after having done something for 30 years and having to do it over and over and over again, it's sometimes difficult to accept that change hasn't happened this quickly.
Yeah.
But I remember one of my social work teachers here at McGill who definitely told me from the beginning, change is not something you're going to see probably in your lifetime.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you're going to stop. You take a break once in a while, as I do, as every activist I know does.
Yeah.
But you don't stop.
Mm-hmm. So like that. Yesterday, you did a book launch on this book. We went there. I forget what was the name of the book.
From the Edge, Woman with Disability.
The Women's of the Edge. And you were talking about you were part of the women's rights disability movement.
That's right. I was part of the 17 women that started the Disabled Women's Network, as well as the local Action Femmes Handicapées Montréal movement. I was never alone. I work in team with Echo Access, with two. I work in team for two reasons. First of all, I believe in diversity. And diversity can't come from just one person. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you were asking me before about Montreal.
Yeah.
You know, Montreal is the least accessible city in North America, not only for people that use wheelchair, but for all kind of other disabilities, as well as diversity, I would say. We're not able to be inclusive of different diversities. Primarily, at least for people with disability, I can say that the construction code is largely responsible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The construction code does not incorporate the notion of universal design or inclusive design. As I was saying before, those are the principle and the guideline that will lead to a better and more inclusive Montreal.
I think that's true across Canada too. The building code is not even up to anything close to a universal design demand.
Yeah.
That was Tanya speaking.
Yeah, Tanya. Thanks a lot, Tanya.
Thanks, Tanya. I'm studying in distance through inclusive design and built environment in inclusive design master degree. And I can tell you that I was much surprised to find out that their law includes, when it comes to accessibility, vending machine. Yeah. I can only dream of seeing this in Canada anywhere.
Yeah. I want to make opinion. I'm sorry I'm not going following my questions because I feel more comfortable making them up.
Okay, go ahead.
So, I used to be going to Toronto, and I went to the Scotia Bank in Toronto, and I walked in, and I see this prompter, and it's writing all the words backwards, and it's for the people who are deaf to watch the movies, so they could read. They have a mirror and like that, except they don't have this at Scotia Bank in Montreal.
No,
and Montreal. So it's like, why could they have it in Toronto, and they can't have it here, you know?
Precisely. I think that Montreal is, I don't want to bang on Montreal always, but this is where I live and this is what I know. The Quebec Construction Code is one of the least accessible code in the country.
Yeah.
I won't even compare it to anything that the United States has because... Partly because it hasn't been fulfilled, it hasn't been updated, but also because the mentality among people with disability in Quebec still is one of medical model. The problem is within me.
Yeah.
And we don't even have a proper wording for social model or equality right models in the French language.
We gotta move on because I'm thinking I'm holding on to Yolanda. Hello, Yolanda. Is she still there?
Hello. Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
I've been hearing with a lot of interest all what my colleagues have said. Thank you very much for sharing and for inviting me.
Yeah. So
we can continue in the same pattern, but go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Like, I have a couple of questions to ask you. Could you please tell me about apsis?
A cape.
Okay. You can repeat me, because I have problems reading.
No, yeah, don't worry. It's okay. Yeah, well, it's what we do in the Asociación Quebecoise de Estudiantes de Discapacité o Postsecondaire, or in English, the Quebec Association of Postsecondary Students with Disabilities, is to work to promote equalization of opportunities in postsecondary education for students with disabilities. We advocate before the Ministry of Education, the Human Rights Commission, and all the different stakeholders involved in this struggle, well, to ensure that we won't go, at least we won't go backwards. There will be more and more opportunities to ensure, as Maria was mentioning, and Tara as well, and Tanya, that education will be accessible for all, that universal design learning will be a reality. And currently we are in a model of reasonable accommodations, but in fact the ideal model will be universal design for learning, where we don't have to take case by case to ensure that everyone will have access to the right of having an education. Yes, and this association was formed 20 years ago. This is the 20th anniversary of ACAPES. It was formed back in 1991, and it has seen a lot of things going on, improving, and some backlashes lately as well. Because maybe not in post-secondary, but in elementary school in Quebec, there is a strong media campaign to say that inclusive education has gone too far. We participate in all the groups of human rights defense it's far from that. We have not done enough. This is basically what we do. It's human rights defense to ensure equal opportunities, or at least to promote equal opportunities in education for all post-secondary students with disabilities. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. How was APSIS uncovered over the past 20 years?
Oh, well, it started as a small association created by Lucy Brassard, no, who was a woman with a disability that, had to go through a lot of complicated situations to complete her post-secondary education. I think that Maria knows more about this than myself. Basically, what the association has done is to go through different phases of research, of seeing, what's going on in the different institutions, network with other associations, but still it remains a very, very small association. And, it belongs to its members, no? But we have very few members, but we have an important symbolic power of saying, we are present here, we represent the students, and we work basically in four aspects, which is popular education, nonpartisan political action, social representation, and networking. So these are the four in the first things that we do. And, well, I mean, I could tell you a lot that has happened in these 20 years, but it has... I think that Marianne knows much more than myself how education has evolved, post-secondary education has evolved to be more welcoming for students with disabilities. Also Tanya and Tara should. I think that they know much better than myself, you know, because I didn't study here.
So you want to pass your phone?
Yeah. How about I just give you a brief review, because I work with AdaptTech Research Network, which is we do research on students with disability across Canada and Quebec. What we've seen in the last 15 years that I work at AdaptTech is that there is a shift as to the type of disability that are coming into schooling. There seem to be what they call in Quebec City, the la clientèle émergente, which is people, more students with learning disability, students with developmental disability, and other groups, mental health, with mental health issues. The system is totally unprepared for this clientèle émergente. Primarily because there wasn't an expectation. When I first started working with AdaptTech in 1996, the government claimed that there were only 212 students enrolled in post-secondary education. Today, there's a more realistic talk of something up to between 800 and 1,000, which is more realistic if you take the size of Quebec. There's still a lot of students who don't identify as having disability. That is, they don't go to services for students with disability to ask help, yeah, for help. This is something that both need at the national level and ACEP at the, yeah, provincial level has worked on. One thing that I find really interesting about ACAP is that they have now developed a bursary for students with disability that they give out, I think, once a year, Yolanda?
Yes, it's once a year. Yes.
So that helped, because the one thing that students need, and I think this definitely came out of ACAP research, is the fact that there's not a lot of funding. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times students, whether it's physical disability or others, end up dropping off because there is no funding. For example, up to about 1998, the Quebec government did not recognize learning disability. So there were no money given to them as students with disability.
Yeah.
And they, most of them wouldn't qualify as having loan in regular bursary.
Stefan, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
One thing I'm wondering about is the same phenomenon of a dramatic growth in the number of students registered with disability services at U of T who identify as having a mental health issue or a learning disability. Mm-hmm. And no change at all in terms of the student population for mobility impairments, pain impairments, agility impairments. And sometimes I wonder if the structures that say we have to regard disability as an individual issue, if that makes it so that some types of disabilities are getting research attention or funding attention, and other types of disabilities, which have to be, like, if there's only a set of stairs to get into the building, mm-hmm, you can't really solve it on an individual level. Like, I wonder if some of the ways we've even tried to address the problem of exclusion,
yeah,
is helping to reproduce exclusion.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I think...
I don't get you very well, but the situation is that, yeah, I think that in this generation... we have more access to early detection.
Okay, no problem. I just want to say goodbye to Mary because she has to go because she has to get her transport.
I believe I saw it coming.
Really nice to meet you.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Maria.
Yeah. Okay. Can you repeat? You were asking a question for me.
Oh. Okay.
Tanya. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Tanya. Yeah. Yeah. I think that one situation is that now I think that there are more tools to make an early detection of learning disabilities in order to act quickly and maybe be able to help the student to catch up with the rest of the regular students.
So, yeah.
Because I think that in the past, many other many learning disabilities were just not diagnosed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we have so many tools to identify that someone is. In this particular area needs more attention, and there are many issues that were not an issue before, and what happened is that those persons didn't make it.
Okay, just a minute. Hello.
Hi.
Just a minute. You want to say something, Mary?
Yes. Before I leave, because unfortunately, this is part of a question that we live in. When the bus comes, we have to go. I would like to, however, step in on one of your questions about the Charter of Rights.
Yeah.
A little bit of history is that initially people with disability were not welcome in Article 15, and it was quite a fight. Yeah. Maybe Tanya can give you a little bit more of that.
You want to talk?
It was quite a fight on behalf of people with disability in Canada by the Canadian Council of Disability.
Yeah. Tanya, you want to speak about the disability rights?
Or? So I'm going to say goodbye right now.
Yeah, bye. I want to thank you, Mary. Mary, I'm sorry. I want to thank you, and I think we should have more of these panels on the Avalanche. Maybe we could do it somewhere else, like do a remote show where it's more easier for people to come.
Yeah, maybe just a few.
And maybe sometime in the springtime.
In the spring, when
the
snow is gone.
Yeah, when the snow is gone, yeah. So okay, I want to thank you a lot.
Thank you for having us.
Kevin, you want to do, I'll pass it back to you, Kev. Tara, do you want to give some closing remarks? I couldn't believe how fast the time went.
It was. It goes fast when you're having a good time. So it's a very stimulating discussion. I think the point about universal design obviously is maybe a good point to end on too, because you're talking about a variety of needs, and that seems to be a really efficient way, I guess, to address a lot of those. And maybe if we had more of university mandates toward universal design for learning, as well as universal design in a physical sense, then these are the kinds of discussions that we wouldn't have to be having in many ways.
So, Tanya, do you want to say some closing remarks?
I really appreciate the discussion today, and it made me think that, we have changed, like with early diagnosis or with identifying different ways of understanding difference, and I guess I wish that we would change some more and start to think about all the conceptions of normal life and normal environments and what normal people are, if we could start to rethink those as much as we've maybe rethought some of the ways we identify differences.
Yolanda, I'm very sorry to say this. Can you give your closing remarks up a little quick?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just want to insist that equalization of opportunities in education is part of the UN Convention of the Rights of People with Disabilities that was ratified in March 2010 by Canada. So, and this convention has a binding power. And these are basically, you have to go to Article 24 to understand the commitment that Canada made before the international community to ensure equal opportunities for all in education. So, the province government just voted in favor of that. So we are hoping that local laws will be harmonized with the convention soon. Okay, that's all.
So I want to thank all the guests and all coming. It was thanks. So we got to get a little wrap.
Okay, no, thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much, Tanya and Tara. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.